Although President Obama is in L'Aquila, Italy now for the G8 summit, it's really the second important stop of his overseas trip. He began this week in Moscow, meeting with President Dmitry Medvedev and Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. And joining me now to discuss what came out of the state visit is Stephen Cohn, a contributing editor at The Nation and the author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the Cold War, among many books. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, I'm happy to be with you.
President Obama said that he wanted to reset relations with Russia. Did he succeed in doing that earlier this week?
Well, you know, it depends entirely on where you think we were when President Obama took office. In my new book, which you mentioned, I argue that we've been in a new Cold War with Russia since the end of the Soviet Union. Now, if you take that view, then what Obama's calling reset is what we of a certain generation during the last Cold War used to call détente. That is, he's trying to improve a relationship that got very, very bad and very dangerous. If that analysis is correct, he made a start, but it is a very tiny start, and it's going to require a lot of leadership on his part because there are three enormous obstacles, even ticking time bombs, under the agreement that he reached with the Russian government, with Medvedev and Putin, to begin a very serious, far-reaching treaty toward reducing nuclear weapons.
Is it okay?
Only the beginning. Only the beginning.
Is it okay to even say reset nowadays? Didn't it cause a stir when Hillary Clinton presented the Russian foreign minister
well,
with a reset button?
You know, I mean, it's funny on the one hand, and I don't want to be pedantic about it because people who know the Russian language thought it was ridiculous because the Americans got it wrong. But it sent a bad message when they couldn't even find a dictionary to look up the spelling of the Russian word for reset. And Sergei Lavrov, who's the Soviet foreign minister and a kind of formidable guy and rather assertive, though unfailingly polite but stern, immediately pointed out to Mrs. Clinton when she gave him this token that they'd got it all wrong. So it raises a question, maybe not the most profound question, about the competence of the people around Obama when it comes to Russia. And they've made some other rather startling blunders that haven't been made in years in American-Russian relations on their way to Moscow. So, you know, they need some practice.
Well, George W. Bush famously said that he looked into former President Vladimir Putin's soul. You're suggesting that the Russians aren't all that happy to be dealing with a new American president?
No. I think, again, this is my analysis. I can give you a list of a couple thousand people in the United States who think this is wrong. But I think that the Kremlin wants an improved relationship with the United States, not because they're in love with us, but for their own internal need, which is desperately to modernize Russia, which is falling apart at the seams. They don't want a new arms race. They don't want any more military confrontations on their borders, as happened in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia last August, because that was really an American-Russian conflict down there. They really want to be left alone. Now, some people in this country say, well, to leave them alone is to leave them to act badly, and therefore we've got to rein them in. But I think they are very much internal looking at the moment, and they need a long period to rebuild their economy.
Well, just last week, President Obama said that Putin had one foot in the old ways, which may not be the most diplomatic way of creating a reset strategy. Have they tried to calm things down during the trip? Was there a less of a confrontational tone?
I must say, you're quite a diplomat when you said that it was not quite entirely diplomatic of President Putin to say that, President Obama to say that about Putin, because it was the most flagrant breach of presidential protocol that I can remember. Essentially, Obama said that he looked forward to seeing Russian President Medvedev, but not so much Russian Prime Minister Putin, because Putin had a foot in the past, which would be as though, let's say, Medvedev came here to meet Obama and said he looked forward to meeting Obama, but not Vice President Biden, who's not to his taste. It's just not the sort of thing you do. And I don't know whether Obama did it on its own or somebody told him it'd be a good idea in order to build up Medvedev. But yeah, I mean, you know, it was, you know, these summits, as we call them, that was when we both thought we towered above the entire world, so we called them a summit. The two superpowers were looking down on other nations. They're very pre-prepared. They're theatrical events. The first goal, and we should keep this in mind, particularly in this case, was to make two presidents, Obama and Medvedev, are not only young, but they have weak political bases in the capital. Medvedev shares his political base with former President Putin. And as we know, President Obama is having some problems controlling his own Democratic Party. They succeeded in doing that. They both looked good. They sounded good. They smiled. And all conflict was kept behind the scenes. The problem is though it was a good start, as I said before, involving arms control, these three ticking time bombs that I mentioned in the beginning were not, so far as we know, resolved in any way. One is the American expansion of NATO to Russia's borders. That's the key grievance the Russians have. We'll never have a good relationship with Russia unless we stop that. And Obama has said that we're still keen on bringing Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, and that, I think, would be the most reckless and dangerous thing we could do if we want a good relationship with Russia. By the way, that's related to this controversy over missile defense. The second is that both countries, both capitals, are filled with enemies of the reset. There's a lot of opposition to the reset, both in Moscow and Washington. Those people will fight. And thirdly, there's this American impulse to try to promote democracy in Russia and everywhere in the world. But it's backfired on us in Russia. Now, Obama did something interesting. He gave a speech sort of about this where he said, in the past, we've tended to lecture rather than listen, which Russians thought meant we've learned our lesson. We're not going to go into the democracy promotion business here. But then in the second half of the speech, he did some democracy promotion. What you see here is the kind of split within the American impulse or among his advisors on whether this should remain a major plank of American policy toward Russia.
That's
not resolved either.
He said, we obviously still have much work to do with our own democracy in the United States, but nevertheless, that was, I guess, sop to the Russians. I think that we share some common values and interest in building a strong democratic culture in Russia as well as the United States.
Exactly. You put your finger right on it. You see, it's a kind of presumption. I think it's a kind of American conceit. But this has been a factor in American foreign policy toward the world ever since Wilson, that somehow we Americans have been required of history to bring the virtues of our democratic way of life to other countries. I mean, after all, at some point, that's what President Bush said we were doing in Iraq. True, it was an afterthought. Originally, we were looking for weapons of mass destruction. But we've done it in a lot of places. And a lot of people believe, myself included, that this is not only an impossible thing to do, to intervene so deeply in the heart or the soul of another civilization, particularly by America. We're a rather provincial country. We live in a kind of isolation of great oceans away from Europe and Asia. But we persist in doing it, and it rarely ends happily. And with Russia, it was a disaster when we tried it in the 1990s. There's still a struggle in this country. I mean, in the Obama administration, there are people, particularly the Clintonites, the people from the Clinton administration, who committed to themselves to this in the 1990s and want to push on. And then there are the so-called realists, as they're called, who are saying, let's just focus on our vital national interest with Russia, and that's not blowing each other up and fighting terrorism and getting the Russians to help us in Afghanistan. So this debate within the administration and really within the American way of thinking about foreign policy is now underway, and we'll see who's going to win this debate.
But to some degree, haven't tensions eased a bit? First of all, this week the two governments agreed to resume military contacts that were suspended after the Georgia War last year. The two countries renewed their promise to get rid of 34 tons of weapons-grade plutonium. And there was also an agreement to reduce the strategic nuclear arsenals, to open up an air corridor across Russia to send U.S. troops and weapons to Afghanistan. That's about 4,500 flights a year. They would all suggest that there's been real progress.
All right. I mean, you're right. And I began by saying some progress was made, but, and then I listed the obstacles and the dangers and said we're only at the beginning of the road. We'd revisit this in some weeks or months or years. On the other hand...
But by the way, interestingly, all of those agreements involved military things.
That's right. I was about to say, on the other hand, how quintessentially Cold War is all that? That's what we did for 40 years with the Soviet Union. We tried to rein in a conflict so it wouldn't approach some kind of apocalypse with all the weapons both sides had. And a lot of that they did in Moscow, exactly as you say, was military. I mean, one of the problems is, is that when the Soviet Union ended, we had a chance to establish a political relationship with Russia. This is one of the arguments I make in this new book. And through a series of unwise policies, we ended up with a military relationship with Russia, which is what we had during the Cold War. And that's why when Obama decided he wanted to change the relationship for the better, he had to begin with the military. One other point. If you and I were lawyers and we sat down and we looked on all these agreements, at all these agreements they agreed upon, and I don't know, maybe you were trained as a lawyer, I wasn't, but you'd see that these are agreements that we had in the past that got broken off, arms control, for example, or they were agreements already in place that had lapsed, or they were agreements that had been agreed upon going back to the 90s that had never been fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing truly new. You could argue, I think you mentioned one important thing, the Russian agreement to allow American overflights to resupply our troops in Afghanistan. For Obama, who's made Afghanistan his war, his presidency may depend upon it, that's very important. But even there's a question. What did the Russians get in return? We haven't been told. If they didn't get anything in return, that agreement won't be stable in Moscow because the Russian political class, which has a say, is sick of making all the concessions to the United States and getting nothing in return. Probably they got something in return, but we haven't been told yet what it was.
And as you point out, one of the agreements, the getting rid of 34 tons of weapons-grade plutonium, is something that was started in the 1990s and never was completed.
Exactly.
But why was there some discussion about the status of Russia's unilateral bid to join the World Trade Organization?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Because it's interesting, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin announced last month that Russia would pull out of talks and then try to create a trade union with Kazakhstan and Belarus.
Right, exactly right. You know, I don't like to be I told you so, but I've thought from the very beginning that it was unlikely Russia would actually proceed, even if accepted, to World Trade Organization membership for two reasons. Again, the backdrop is never think that the Russian leader, whether it's Putin or Medvedev, operates on his own. He too has a political class. He too needs consensus in that political class, just as Obama has to build, not just as, but in a similar way. Obama has to build a support in Washington. There is no consensus on the WTO in Moscow. There's a powerful lobby in Moscow against WTO for two reasons. First of all, kind of Franklin Delano Roosevelt reason, Russia's been savaged by a Great Depression since the 1990s. Its essential industries, pharmaceuticals, automobiles, poultry industry, have been decimated by free trade because it can't compete with Western products. Therefore, there's been pressure on the leadership to not enact free trade policies. In other words, to protect its industries. That was one factor that led Putin to back off. And the immediate backdrop was the new economic crisis. But the other thing relates to the expansion of NATO. Once we began pushing NATO, a military base, to Russia's border, Russia was desperate to enact bilateral relations with those former Soviet republics on Russia's borders, which NATO was now occupying. The best carrot Russia has are economic relations, gifts, energy, subsidized products to these areas, the Baltics, Central Asia, Georgia, Ukraine. WTO membership prohibits those kind of carrots. So Russia had two reasons, compelling reasons, internal and external. That's why, by the way, when we talk about Russia, rather than immediately villainize them, we ought to ask ourselves, or try to see the world as they see it through the eyes of the Kremlin. Why are they doing this? In what national interest are they taking this stand? I think in the case of the WTO, even if we think they're wrong, it's a rational choice on their part. Now, they may change their mind, but it's not a mystery.
Now, Stephen, just one more thing, because we're pretty much out of time. Much was made in the American media of the fact that the Russians didn't give President Obama the same kind of huge, warm reaction he's received in other countries.
Yeah.
Is that because of their attitude toward the United States in general? I mean, we even had a situation where we were told they were offended that Obama didn't go out one night in Moscow, yeah. Preferred to stay in with his family.
This is the American media having fun with itself. There's a cruder word for it, but I think you understand what I'm
mm-hmm.
saying. They need to write about something. They're a little lazy. They don't go out beyond the parameters of the event. The reason is that, you know, the Western world has gone crazy over President Obama for reasons that have to do with the Western world, not Russia. Russia's a different civilization. Secondly, Russia's kind of sick of all leaders. They went crazy over their own leaders for a while, Gorbachev and Yeltsin. It ended badly. So they're very constrained about this. And finally, there is a racial element. Anti-racism runs very deep in Russia, very, very deep. It's not directed so much toward black people is as it is toward their own people of color in the Caucasus. And that coolness expressed a kind of curiosity. Why is an African-American, a black man, president of the United States? They don't understand it. And so it was a kind of not hostility, but kind of reserved curiosity rather than this bubbling reaction that President Obama's gotten elsewhere. But there's nothing sinister in it and nothing politically important in it.
Stephen Cohn's latest book is Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the Cold War. He's a contributing editor to The Nation. Thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure. Thank you.